Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of my shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. Well, today I'm interviewing Mark Feinberg, director of Play the Game with Doris Roberts and Andy Griffith, and a really great cast. I think I have him on the line. Let me see right here. Okay, Mark, are you there?
I'm here. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
You are welcome. You've done a lot of great things, but I think I want to start talking about Play the Game because most people probably know you for Play the Game. So tell me a little bit about this great comedy that you put together. It's been a couple of years, but how did you get Andy Griffith and Doris Roberts and the Howards and all these great people involved in your film?
Well, you know, I had to do it like they do it in Hollywood. I had to sleep around and, you know, no, it didn't work that way. I guess you could say I got a little lucky. I had a pretty good script and, you know, after the fact, Andy Griffith told me that he chose my script for two reasons. Number one, he didn't die at the end of the script. And number two, he got to have a sex scene. So,
yeah.
You know, he was only partially joking. I think the old adage of, you know, giving an actor something interesting that they haven't done before is true. You know, older actors, even Andy Griffith, just don't get offered a lot of parts where they're, you know, one of the stars and they don't, you know, die at the end. Typically, they give their little piece of advice to the main character and then they have to die so that the main character can go off and do it on their own without grandpa around to help them. So that's what attracted him. And then, you know, it was a similar idea for Doris Roberts and Liz Sheridan, who played the other leading role. They just didn't get an opportunity to play roles where they got to have a love interest and be in a, you know, romantic relationship on screen. So, you know, you give them that, and they'll flock to your movie. It was really good in that sense.
Now, how did you even approach them? Did you go through their agents? Did you happen to know them, have a connection personally?
No, I wish I had connections. It was all through their agents. I just I approached them through their agents, and then, you know, it did. There was a little bit of a snowball effect in that, you know, once we got one person, once we got Andy, you know, Doris and Liz were obviously much more interested in the project because they wanted to work with Andy and, you know, kind of made it seem like it was not just an average independent movie. So, so that was kind of how we used that to our advantage.
Okay. And for those of the people out there that haven't seen it, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about the plot of the film so that they know?
Yeah, sure. So it was about a young ladies' man who teaches all his dating tricks to his grandfather. And, you know, Andy was the grandfather. The young ladies' man was an amazing guy named Paul Campbell, who does a lot of TV work. He's done a lot of great movies. And I don't know how I was lucky enough to get him either. He was a little bit of a catch. And and his love interest was played by Milo Sokoloff. Again, you know, someone who does much bigger stuff than independent movies, and you know, I was really lucky to get her too.
Yeah, and what was it like working with such a diverse cast? You have kind of, you know, they're not necessarily new, but they're definitely newer than Andy Griffith and Doris Roberts. So you have quite a diversity of experience. What was it like working in that mix, and what were some of your favorite moments on the set?
You know, the interesting thing, certainly, you know, Andy and Doris and Liz, you know, had decades more experience than Paul and Marla. But I'll tell you this. I had done some short films before this feature movie. And, you know, I was working with actors that were just getting started. And, you know, it was difficult. They required a lot of direction. The difference between, you know, an actor with decades and Paul and Marla, for me, because I had been working with very green actors, you know, the experience for me was very easy. I would watch the scene, and 9 times out of 10, everybody would do it exactly how I envisioned it originally.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say cut, and we'd move on. And then you know, that 10th time, I'd give a little bit of direction to Andy or to Paul or to Marla or to Doris. And then they would do exactly what I was looking for, even if I didn't describe it in the most colorful terms. They just sort of knew, and they did it like, they're like, oh yeah, I got it. I see what you want. And then it would just happen. It was fantastic. I mean, there's also a saying that I didn't fully appreciate until after I directed this movie, that 90% of directing is casting, and that's
mm-hmm.
completely true. Completely true.
Yeah.
I mean, when you only have to give one piece of direction and then you get exactly what you need, you know, if that, it makes it very easy.
Yeah. Did you do a casting besides the bigger people in the film? Did you also have like an open casting for everybody else, or how did that work?
Yeah, we did. We had an open casting for all the other stuff. You know, there were a lot of other roles and we found a lot of great actors. It was really a difficult process in that, you know, I tell my actor friends this, the surprising thing to me was, There were several roles where I knew right away, like, that's, you know, this is the best actor, and they're doing it 20 times better than the others, and this is the person I want. And then there were other roles where it was more difficult, in that there were probably 4 or 5 actors that I thought, you know, they've all got the chops, they've all got the experience, they've all got the emotion to do this role. And it really
mm-hmm.
just came down to, you know, I want the short guy with the bald head versus the tall guy with the head. You know, it really came down to looks, which
I
kind of felt bad about, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think actors kind of know that's the game they're in, and a lot of it's out of their control. It's just sort of the look that people are looking for.
Yeah.
But we were very lucky. I mean, when you cast a movie in Los Angeles, it's different. You know, I made my short films in other cities. When you cast a film in Los Angeles, there's just such a huge talent pool that it's
mm-hmm.
very easy to find great actors. I mean, there's just so many good actors and not enough parts for them that, you know, it's kind of a director's market, I guess, if you will.
Since you've worked in other markets, what for those that are kind of in the smaller markets versus LA, maybe you can give a little insight into what the difference is in other ways within the business as far as shooting a film and the permitting and everything else. Is it a lot more difficult in LA?
Well, like the logistics more difficult
mm-hmm.
in LA?
Yeah.
Good question. Probably, because you can't just, you know, run and gun. You know, I don't think we got any permits
mm-hmm.
When I was shooting my short film, and nobody ever
right.
gave us a hard time because nobody ever saw cameras before. You know, we choose a location that nobody had ever been to, and they were just kind of excited to see a camera, you know, if they even noticed you. And in Los Angeles, there were several instances where, you know, I think we got permits for everything, which was expensive, number one. And then
mm-hmm.
there were a couple instances where people saw us and made a little bit of noise, and, you know, we had to create incentives to people to make them stop making the noise. You know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was
wow.
intentional, they were just going about their day, but... you know, I think people are a little bit more savvy about that kind of stuff. So, you know, I just think you have to be a little bit more by the book in L.A. just because people are they're used to seeing a lot of cameras. And it, you know, it makes sense. You can't, you know, if there's so many people shooting films here, you can't just have people, you know, closing down the streets every day.
Right. How long did it take you to shoot the movie?
It was a 6-week shoot, I believe.
Wow.
We had a lot of time to shoot it for an independent film,
mm-hmm.
but it also turned out to be not that much time because one of the rookie mistakes I think I made was we had way too many locations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we probably had 30 days of shooting, and I think we had just about 30 locations. So we were
wow.
moving almost. You know, the days, there were a couple days where we didn't move. We stayed in one place for 2 or 3 days. But then there were other days where we had to move 2 or 3 times. And I didn't fully
wow.
I didn't fully understand exactly how much shooting time you lose by moving a crew of 50 people around. By the way, you'll have to excuse me. I caught this flu that's going around, so I still have a lingering cough. I'm not normally so spastic on the phone.
That's okay. So you definitely would not shoot in so many locations next time, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, put it this way. If I'm going to make that mistake, I'm going to have 12 weeks of shooting if I have so many locations. But, yeah, it wasn't worth it. I mean, as a director, I wanted the scene to be where it was. But as a director, I also would have loved to have a couple more angles on my shots and a couple more times to shoot it and a couple more setups and we were just running around like crazy, just trying to get stuff, in the can and trying to make our days that, excuse me, it became a lot, we spent a lot of time on logistics rather than on shooting. So, it's much more fun to set up your cameras and let the actors do their thing a lot and have, do some improv and try a couple different things, which we were able to do on some days, but, there's a scene in the movie that ended up being about 25 seconds in the movie that was originally planned to be about a 2-minute shot, a very complicated shot of probably 4 different scenes. Now, on the one hand, that's a bad thing because we were so behind that I had to take all this information that was packed into, 4 different scenes and combine it into a 25-second scene. But on the other hand, it ended up being good for the movie. Being under the gun like that, it forces you as a director to just focus on the important stuff. And it was better for the movie because all the stuff that I was going to put in, there were some jokes I lost that I thought were funny. But in terms of what the audience needed to see, there was only really 25 seconds worth of it. And so it forced me to really, consolidate everything and focus it down into something much more concise. So there's a positive side to it as well. And I definitely earned my keep in terms of figuring out how to take a 3-minute scene and turn it into a 25-second scene and just, change a scene completely on the set. It's not easy to do, but I think it's probably one of my strengths as a director.
So it helps you to edit it, basically, putting it together.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, and you're always self-editing, every stage of the game. But it teaches you to be much more concise, and it sort of packs the information in. And I'm the type of filmmaker, if I can make a 1.5-hour movie with, X amount of information versus 2X, I'd rather pack in, twice as many plot points and twice as many twists and have each scene be half as long and, maybe I lose something in terms of the color and feel and emotion. I would much rather have a much more dense script. I'm a big fan of the show 30 Rock, and, I think of all the shows on the air right now, they had this density to their script where you really had to pay attention because within 30 seconds they'd say 3 different things that were important to the plot and have, 5 jokes. Whereas most shows, I think they aim for like 3 jokes a page, and I think 30 Rock was probably 6 jokes a page, who knows? So that's, I think that's interesting to me, at least as a director.
What do you think are the elements that make a good comedy? Just keep them going, keep them laughing, or what would you say?
Wow. Rachel, you're coming up with the stumpers.
your film is so cute and funny. There were so many little funny bits within the movie, and yet it wasn't like one of those that was just a comedy. It was a sweet movie. It had a lot of elements to it. So, how did you, because you wrote this, so how did you implement that? Did you think about it as you were writing it, or did it just come naturally?
Well, I think there's 2 things that come straight to mind in terms of what I find in, the comedies I like. Number one is, actually, I won't even say comedy, but I think you have to, a great movie has the audience experiencing a range of emotion. So there's, I love the movie Airplane as much as the next guy.
Yeah.
And there were jokes, you know, just hilarious roll on the floor jokes throughout the whole movie every couple of seconds. But, you know, you didn't, it was kind of slapstick. You never really felt for the characters. You knew what was going to happen at the end. And even when, you know, the love interest got together at the end, you know, did it really affect you? No. If you can make a movie where you're laughing hysterically in one scene and then 5 minutes later you're slowly working your way up to an emotional scene where you cry, I think that's, that's a powerful movie. And then in terms of answering your original question, which is, you know, just how do you make it, how do you make a good comedy, just how do you make it funny? I think it's, you know, it's certainly, I would say, quality over quantity, but quantity is important too. But, you know, the question is, how do you define that quality? And I think it's probably something where you have to sort of pick your tone and stick with it and then really, really hit the notes in that tone. So, you know, ours wasn't a slapsticky broad comedy. It was, you know, it was a real life comedy. Everything we did had to be, you know, either something that could happen in real life or something that, you know, in a very rare instance you'd see on a, you know, on a YouTube funny video. You know, it couldn't be something that you would never believe would happen. So that's kind of the tone we hit. And then, you know, the best comedies to me are comedies where everything that's funny is funny because it's true. It's funny because people go, yeah, that happened to me, or yeah, that I totally see that. It's something they know to be true, but they never really thought about. You know, that's like a show like Seinfeld, that's kind of the key to his humor, I think. You know, his observational humor is everything he says is something that you instantly agree with when he says it, but you never really gave any thought to it. You never really noticed. And so to me, that's at least my sense of humor in this movie. That's kind of what I want. You know, there's a point in the movie that gets a lot of laughs where the Marlo Sokolov's character says, you know, something about, you know, you're like a brother to me. And everybody just sort of laughs and cringes at that moment, because I think every guy has heard that and every girl has said that to somebody. And they all know what that means and what that implies and how it feels. And so people just sort of, you know, it's truthful to them, I think. But it's also sad and funny for the character at the moment. So to me, I think that's one of the keys.
Mm-hmm. You must have had a lot of funny moments on the set with you know, Doris Roberts and Andy Griffith and everybody.
Oh, God, yeah.
Maybe you could share a few.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was one of those things, you know. You've got a low-budget independent movie, and, you know, everybody's sort of forced to hang out, you know, in smaller spaces than they'd like, and a lot of stuff happened. I would say, you know, one of the funniest things was sort of significant of the relative experience levels of me and Andy. So, you know, Andy's been acting for a decade before I was even born. And and there was a moment when, you know, it was one of the first days on set, and of course I was nervous directing Andy Griffith. And I wanted him to, you know, sort of lean into the shot, and I said, yeah, and I just want you to sort of step into the shot, you know, put your foot here and then lean in. And he said, yeah, yeah, Mark, I know what it means to step into the shot. And the entire set just broke out in laughter that here I am not noticing it at the moment, but, I'm, you know, here I am teaching Andy the basics of what I want him to do. And I'm like, it was something that sort of made me blush, but he was obviously great about it. He knew from the start, you know, that you know, I was nervous about directing Andy Griffith, but, you know, I got very lucky in that I didn't hire any actor that was one of those, you know, diva Hollywood actors that you hear about. That would have been that's kind of devastating for a first-time director to have to show up on set and deal with something like that. They were all very gracious, and they understood, you know, it was a low-budget film, and, you know, there were no power struggles or anything like that. You know, for an actor like Andy and Doris to come on set and take direction from a guy who's, you know, been in the business for a fraction of what they've done, they were great, and I learned a lot from them. And they were good in that they helped me too. You know, they suggested, you know, I would give them a piece of direction. They go, yeah, let's try it that way. And you know, if it didn't work, they'd say, you know, maybe we should do this. And ultimately, here's the scary thing. My movie was based on my grandfather, who obviously I knew very well. So it's not like I just made this character out of thin air. It was based on a man that I grew up with. And I wrote the film, so I knew the character very well. And then this guy, Andy Griffith, comes in, and instantaneously, he knows more about this character than I do. The things he's doing, the things he's bringing to the character, the way he's saying things that I didn't intend, and the things he's adding that I didn't intend, were reflective of someone who knew the character more than the writer did. And that, I thought, was just amazing to see. That a guy, that's when you really fully appreciate, you know, what that guy had in his head, you know, over the years, what he learned as an actor. And it was just awesome to watch. And, you know, I learned early on, you know, most of the time, the best way to direct Andy Griffith is to stand back and watch him act. And that's when great stuff happened. So that was probably the best experience I had on set.
So where can people watch this now? Is it on Netflix? Or where can they see it?
Yeah, it's, you know, pretty much we got the distribution almost everywhere we could hope to get distribution. So you can stream it on Netflix. You can rent it on Netflix. You can watch it. It's still playing on Showtime. You can rent it on iTunes and Amazon and everywhere else. So there is playthegamemovie.com. Don't forget the movie part, playthegamemovie.com. And you can still buy a DVD if you're one of the people that needs the hard copy. You know, it's we were very lucky to get distribution everywhere we wanted, and including the theaters. We played in theaters about 6 months, almost 300 theaters, and we earned almost $700,000. So we had a great run in theaters, and the nice byproduct of that is that when you do that well in the movie theaters, all the other distributors sort of pay more attention, and so we got everybody calling us, and so now we're on television and Netflix and internationally. Like even those of you listening to this in Malaysia and Singapore and Latin America can find it on television somewhere. It's funny, we have, you know, every week I get a comment on our Facebook page in some foreign language that they love the movie. I think it's they love the movie. I don't really know what they're saying, but you know, it's crazy because every week it's a different country that's commenting on the film. It's interesting.
Kind of the wonders of technology. And speaking of technology, see that? That's a nice segue. Tell me about the new movie you're working on called Facebook Revolution.
Like
that segue?
It's a great segue. Yeah, and it's that's exactly what it's about. It's about this remote village in Africa, untouched by technology, and then they get the internet. And this young girl in the village, you know, who is kind of sad because she wanted to do bigger things with her life, and there's sexism in the village, and she's forced to, you know, knit fabric with the rest of the women, but she wants to do something big with her life. And this computer finally gives her the opportunity, and, you know, she uses Facebook and Twitter and Google and eBay to bring all this great technology to the village, and she gets all this power, and, you know, this young girl starts becoming more and more powerful in the village, and the chief becomes threatened. And in the end, some of the technology that she brings to the village goes bad, and, you know, as technology sometimes do, sometimes technology is good, sometimes it's it's not. And in the end, you know, technology in a way causes a cholera epidemic. And she has to figure out some way of using Google and Facebook and Twitter to save her village from a cholera epidemic and save her entire country by overthrowing this evil ruler. And, you know, much like what happened with, you know, the Arab Spring countries in Egypt and Tunisia. You know, it's kind of inspired by those events of how Facebook and Twitter played a huge role in overthrowing, you know, the despotic rulers in those countries. So that's kind of what's interesting to me about it. Is, you know, inspired a little bit by true events and brings, you know, technology to places that I haven't seen it before. A lot of people, everybody always asks me, you know, do you remember the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy? So it kind of brings back memories of The Gods Must Be Crazy, but instead of a Coke bottle falling from the sky, it's a computer. So.
And it was chosen as one of the top 30 scripts in the Nickel. Is it Nickel Fellowship?
Yeah,
I don't know much about that. Tell me about that.
So the Nickel Fellowship is probably the most prestigious screenwriting competition in the world. I think it's one of those that sometimes makes people's careers. You know, there's a lot of contests that don't really mean anything, and that's probably the one that gets cited over and over as meaning something big. While, you know, unfortunately didn't win the contest, you know, out of 6,000 or 7,000 scripts, you know, we ended up in the top 30. So we knew we had something special, and, you know, I think we've made enough progress on it now to know that it's an interesting story that hasn't really been told before. So, you know, that's what we're building on, and we're trying to, you know, we're raising money exactly how a movie like this should be raised. We're raising it from the technology community up in San Francisco. You know, in Silicon Valley is where investors are coming from. And and we are going to start our crowdsourcing campaign soon. And our goal is to fund 100% of the movie from crowdsourcing, which is a pretty significant goal. The biggest movie crowdsourcing campaign to date has been in the $400,000 range, which is doable. You know, movie like this, we're going to shoot it in Africa probably, and you know, I think our budget's going to end up being a little bit more than that. So we've got our work cut out for us, but you know, we're thinking that a movie about social, you know, about social media and about technology, we should be raising the money and marketing the movie, you know, as much through social media as possible. So that's kind of our strategy.
And how do people find out more about it if they want to contribute?
They should sign up with our list at playthegamemovie.com, because everybody that followed that movie will be on the list for this one. So, you know, we're still sort of stealth on that, but go to playthegamemovie.com and sign up for our newsletter. And when we begin all our social media for Facebook Revolution, you will be included on that as well.
Okay, and you're also working on a spy thriller. Tell me about that, too.
Yeah, that is in the script stage. I'm writing a spy thriller. It's, you know, kind of a... We hope it's a unique twist on spy films. It's kind of a combination of James Bond and Survivor a little bit. It's nice to be working on a project that's, you know, it's one of those movies that has to be big budget. It's not something that I will probably direct myself unless I get very lucky. You know, it's something with a lot of explosions, a lot of stunts. So it's great in that as a writer I can be completely, you know, I don't have to worry about, well, I'm not going to be able to shoot this. So there's no self-censoring. I'm, you know, somebody else's problem whether they can shoot what I put on paper. So I'm just being, I'm just putting down, you know, what I want to as a writer, which is, it's nice. And I think it probably helps in making it more creative.
What would be your advice for a director that's kind of been doing localized films and wants to kind of make the next big step into something that is going to get distribution? What would be your advice on how to do that?
Well, you know, finally you've asked me a question that I think I know the answer to. That one I think is straightforward. I'm happy to get that question because I think that's probably the most common mistake that I think independent directors and producers make. You look at a lot of the stuff that shows up at film festivals as people's first, second, third film, and they get lauded. They get complimented as really artistic, beautiful films, but they're not considered commercial films, and that's what people like about them. So for me, I never got into those films, so I always wanted to make commercial films. And that hurt Play the Game when we got to the festival circuit because it wasn't a festival movie. It wasn't a very artistic movie. It was a commercial movie. But it certainly helped us when we got into the movie theater, and it helped us when we got to finding, trying to get interest from distributors. So I would say try and make a movie that is commercial. That doesn't mean try and make a movie that is formulaic. I think there is a balance. There's a way to do both. There's a way to make a commercial movie that still has elements of originality in it. But what would you consider commercial?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think the biggest thing that I see is some of the artsy type movies I go see, they don't have a beginning, middle, and an end. They have a beginning and a middle, and as you're watching the movie, I'm always thinking to myself, well, what has to happen for an ending to happen? Like, what am I hoping to see either one way or the other? Either the person lives or dies. Either the person finds the thing they're looking for or they don't. Either the person makes it to California or they don't. A lot of independent movies don't have that thing that we are trying to get to. It's just a bunch of events that are interesting at the moment, but there's nothing that is going to signal to us the ending of a movie. And then I find that a lot of those movies, they just sort of simply fade to black, and then everybody's like, all right, is that the end? Is that the end? And the credits come up like, oh, yeah, that's the end. And to me, I don't think that's what people, what the masses of people are used to. I don't think that, to me, that's not what makes a great story, personally, but, other people disagree, obviously. So at the very least, I would say you need to have a story that adheres to three-act structure because that's what we're trained to enjoy in this culture for the most part. There's always going to be exceptions, but I think there are very few exceptions. I would say don't go too far the other way either. I see a lot of filmmakers that are trying to make a commercial movie that then have every scene that looks like a scene we've seen in 1,000 movies. Like the opening scene will be something where they're walking down the street and something explodes and then they get away. And it's exciting, but it's something that we've seen 1,000 times before. And, the bar that's been set for us as newbies, as rookies, is it's not, it's fine for a guy like J.J. Abrams to do a scene like that, if it's got big enough explosions, because that's great. But I think for new directors, we have to take something like that and put a twist in it in some way where something happens that is unexpected, but it's not something that surprises us enough that it takes us out of the movie in the first scene. It's like you gotta be original, but you can't be too original. That's the fine line that I think I work on as a director and a writer every day to find that magic middle where I'm being original, but I'm not being so original that people, aren't used to the structure of the film.
Well, we are running out of time already, believe it or not. That was great. we actually are running out of time, but I want to make sure that if you have another website that you want to give for yourself so people can kind of follow what you're doing, that would be great.
So the best one is still Play the Game Movie, but my production company is at storyfilmsinc.com, STORY, storyfilms, FILMS, and then inc, INC.com. And that's where you can see some of the other projects we're working on and stuff we're doing. But to stay in contact, the best way to stay in contact and hear about the new projects is to sign up on our Play the Game movie subscription list.
Okay, and hopefully once you get the Facebook Revolution done, we can bring you back and talk about that one too.
I would love to do that. I hope it's
And I know you have other projects going on too that we just ran out of time for, but...
Yeah, listen, I will be happy to be back. It's always a struggle getting a film in the can, but it's an amazing thing when it happens. So I'll be happy to share once I get the next one going.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Mark. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, we just talked with Mark Feinberg. That was an excellent interview, and if you missed any of that, you can go back and listen to it in its entirety. It will be archived here to listen to later. And like I said, we had a lot of other projects that he's done in the past and that he's working on for the future that we didn't get a chance to talk about, but hopefully he'll come back and speak more about those. In the meantime, you can go to the Play the Game movie website, and you can get on his newsletter, like you said, and he will inform you about some of the upcoming projects that he's doing. Okay, guys. Well, let's see. If you didn't miss it, if you missed our show last week, I interviewed Julie Dyer from The Playroom. So you can also go back and listen to that, as well as the many different directors and film professionals that I've interviewed over this last year. And if you are one of those filmmakers that would like to be on the show, I would love to have you. Please email me. My email is ravenprods, RAVENPRODS at yahoo.com, and I would be happy to look at your stuff and see if I can bring you on board. And for those that are listening from the Florida area, there's some film stuff going on right now. I don't know if you know about the fact that Sarah Jessica Parker was just in Miami with Jeremy Piven and some other people from the movie Miami Rhapsody. They were just here, and it's kind of part of a promotion for the upcoming Miami International Film Festival, which is running March 1st through 10th. So if you are in the area, you may want to check that out. That is coming up, gosh, well, it's still a month away, I guess, but it's just around the corner, so make some time for that. And I will be back next week with more interviews, so please tune in next week at the same time. Thanks so much, guys. And in the meantime, check out my Facebook page, which is Indie Streak, just like the name of this show. Thanks. Bye.